Chapter 35. Sea Glass, 1988. It was Halloween, 1988. My mother had slowly withdrawn from the world after her breakup with Mr. Kennedy, who seemed intent on drinking himself to death again. And there was a strange, melancholy mood at Sea Glass that October. The sorrow and sadness seemed to seep out of the cracks in the walls. I remember walking into the room that evening and finding my family all there, sitting around the kitchen table, seated in their individually painted chairs. Nancy was sitting in her tall, thin, white chair, looking beautiful but uncomfortable, as always. My dad, then fully recovered from his car accident, sat at the other end of the table, as far away from Nancy as possible. Just because she didn't want to be with Mr. Kennedy, it didn't change the status of their relationship. Nancy didn't want to be with Dad, either. Not in that way. Not then. His chair seemed a little wider and rounder and darker than before, as though it had aged with him. 18-year-old Rose sat in her red chair, next to Connor, who visited so often by then that Nana had painted him a chair of his own. It was sky blue, with little white clouds, because she said he was a dreamer. 17-year-old Lily looked sulky and jealous in her green chair. She'd had an audition for a drama school in London the day before and didn't get in. Lily couldn't handle the knockback, so gave up on her dreams of performing on stage after just one rejection. I guess they didn't like her rendition of Eternal Flame. Even at 13, I understood that if you really wanted something, you had to fight for it. Always. But my mother, who had also dreamt of being an actress, did nothing to encourage Lily to try again. Almost as though she couldn't stand the possibility of her daughter succeeding when she had failed. That thought might be unkind, but I think it might also be true. She spoilt Lily even more than before after that, unlike Rose and I, which only made matters worse. The problem with growing up with parents who say yes to everything is that it doesn't prepare you for the real world, which often says no. I've never known my sister to work hard for anything or anyone, not even herself. The reality of hard work being a prerequisite for success meant she was doomed to fail. There was one other guest at the kitchen table that day, but he didn't have a chair of his own. I've always presumed that Nana's agent was roughly the same age as my father. When I was a child, anyone over 30 looked the same age to me. Old. But staring at the screen now, and seeing Nana's agent again for the first time in years, I notice he was surprisingly young. Early 30s at most. I remember that she was his first real client, and the success of Daisy Darker's Little Secret launched his career as well as hers. She took a chance on him, he took a chance on her, and it paid off in a big way. Until she stopped writing a few years ago. Nana's agent was sitting next to her that night, on a dark blue chair covered in shooting stars reserved for special guests. My chair, decorated with hand-painted daisies, was next to his. I hadn't met him before. It sounded strange to my ears when she talked about having an agent. To me, she was always just my Nana. But I was curious about this man who she was clearly rather fond of. Her birthday party was normally a family-only event. Nana said that she could count the people she trusted on one hand, and that she didn't need all of her fingers to do it. Her agent was the person she trusted most. He wore a smart suit and a kind smile. I had always imagined him carrying books inside all of his pockets, but I couldn't see any. "It's such a pleasure to finally meet the real Daisy Darker," he said as I sat down at the table. He held out his hand for me to shake as though I were a grown-up, and that, along with his posh voice, made me smile. He pronounced all of his words properly, which made me want to do the same. I found myself imitating the way he spoke without meaning to. Nana's agent was like a character in a book or a film, and I wasn't entirely convinced he was real until I touched him. "That's a good firm handshake," he said. "Thank you," I replied, rather pleased with myself. As a slightly awkward 13-year-old, I took compliments wherever I could get them. "What do you mean, the real Daisy Darker?" "Well, I work with your Nana. Her book, Daisy Darker's Little Secret, was the first book we worked on together a few years ago, and it's sold all over the world. Which means there are copies of a book with your name on it in bookshops in America and Spain, Australia, Poland, even as far away as China. It's quite a thrill to finally meet your Nana's muse." I didn't know what a muse was, but didn't want the nice man to think that I was stupid, so I nodded. I might be misremembering things. It was a long time ago now. There was a twinkle in his eyes as he spoke, and I wondered if the nice man was secretly made of stars. His chair was covered in them, after all, and Nana was right about most things. Every family is a fortress that few outsiders get to see inside, especially ours. Sometimes people are invited in for a period of time, but they only ever get the public tour. They never really see behind the scene. Access all areas is a myth when it comes to human relationships. We can never really know another person, because we rarely know ourselves. Knowing that Nana's agent was one of the very few people on the planet who she trusted, I always wondered and wanted to know why. But whenever I asked her, she could never explain. Maybe she didn't really understand it herself. "You do know that my Nana's stories aren't real, don't you?" I asked him. "What she writes is called fiction." The agent smiled. "Yes, I am aware of the term." "Then you should really understand that I am not the Daisy Darker in the books. Nana just borrowed my name, that's all. A book about the real me would be far more interesting." He laughed at that, and it made me cross because I thought it meant he didn't think that I was interesting. But then Nana's agent gave me something wonderful, which made me like him again. He reached into the top pocket of his jacket and took out a silver pen. Then he took out a business card and wrote on the back of it, "Looking forward to reading about the real Daisy Darker." What was most remarkable was that, with a simple click, the pen could write in different colours. Red, green, blue and black. I'd never seen anything like it. He gave me the business card, and when he saw me staring at the pen, he gave me that too. "Here you go. Write your own story with this, if you like, and I'll read it if you do." Then Nana tapped her champagne glass to get everyone's attention, and our conversation was over almost as soon as it had begun. I put the pen and the card in the top pocket of my dress. I see on the video that it was a dress of my own, rather than a hand-me-down, a denim dungaree dress, not unlike the ones I still like to wear today. I also had my first shoes that had only been worn by my feet, a pair of white trainers that Nana had painted with daisies. "Now then, I know it's Halloween and some people have a party to go to," Nana said, looking at Rose and Lily, "but I'm glad we could be together for a little while. It means a lot to have my family in one place all at the same time for my birthday. Cheers to all of you. And special congratulations to Rose for getting into Cambridge University. We're so proud of you." I was only 13, but even I was allowed a glass of champagne. I liked it and tried to sip it as slowly as possible to make it last. "Shall we do presents before dinner?" Nana asked, and everyone looked uncomfortable. It had always been her rule that nobody was allowed to buy proper presents on her birthday, only sweets, with it being Halloween. I'd already given her a Cadbury's Dairy Milk miniatures dispenser, which she had seemed thrilled with, and Rose gave her chocolate frogs. Dad bought an expensive box of chocolates all the way from Switzerland, where he'd spent the summer with his orchestra. Lily forgot, as usual, so Nancy pretended her gift of milk tray was from both of them. Don't panic. I'm only teasing. You all being present is present enough, Nana said. Her agent cleared his throat.
I didn't know about the no big gifts rule, so I'm afraid I did get you something. I hope you'll forgive me.
He reached beneath the table and put a large, beautifully wrapped gift box on it.
Oh my goodness, said Nana, beaming like a child. What is it?
Open it and see.
Nana lifted the lid, revealing the hand-carved wooden Scrabble set that Trixie and I were playing with earlier this evening. Her agent even had some of the small square letters made with real sea glass on the bottom and driftwood on top, with a letter and value carved into each one. I thought they were beautiful.
It's hard to know what to get someone who loves words but already has all the books they want in their own little library. You always say it's important to use your words, and I know you like the game, he said, sounding more like Nana than himself.
His eyes seemed to twinkle again, and I noticed how very blue they were, just like hers. They wore similar smiles on their faces, too. They looked like a mother and her son celebrating a special moment together.
It's the most wonderful gift I have ever received, she replied.
And I think we all felt a bit sheepish about what we had given Nana. Her agent had made more of an effort than her own family.
I had forgotten until now that he gave her the beautiful wooden Scrabble board.
Before I can think too long about the significance of that, the home movie continues.
Thank you. I'll treasure this always, Nana said. I actually bought myself a gift this year too, and I wanted to share it with all of you before we start eating, she added with a mischievous grin, then shuffled out of the room.
I noticed that her slippers matched her new dress, which was pink and purple and covered in tiny hearts. We all watched from the kitchen table as she wandered out into the hall before disappearing inside her library. She continued to talk to us the entire time, shouting a little in order to be heard.
Now, as all of you know, because I've complained about it often enough, things can get a little lonely here at times, when none of you come to visit and I am left alone with just my characters for company. I've checked the dates on all of your cards by the punch clock, and I'm not imagining being on my own more than before. So, my gift to myself this year is a rather special one. I'd like you all to meet Poppins.
The puppy on the TV screen is ridiculously cute and so small. It's hard to believe that she grew into the giant old English sheepdog currently sleeping in front of the fire, with hair so long now that it is plaited with ribbons to keep it out of her eyes. It's also hard to believe that she first arrived at Seaglass all those years ago. The old dog managed to outlive Nana, which is something nobody would have predicted, not even a palm reader in Land's End. Miniature Poppins was passed around, and we all made a big fuss of her. I watched Nana's agent as he smiled at the puppy and decided that if Nana trusted the man with stars in his eyes, I would too.
If I write a story about the real Daisy Darker, will you really read it?
I whispered. He smiled again.
Yes, I promise that I will.
Daisy, stop bothering the man with your silly stories, said my mother, passing Poppins to Rose.
Nancy never had any real interest in dogs or books.
Oh, I don't mind at all, Nana's agent said with that kind smile of his. Finding the stories hidden inside people's heads is my most favourite thing to do.
We look like a happy family on the screen, and it's a nice memory to be reminded of. As usual, the Halloween birthday menu Nana had prepared for us all catered to her sweet tooth. That year, we had chocolate chili con carne for the first time, along with chicken and hot chocolate gravy, jelly babies and sweet corn,
chocolate-filled ravioli, fish fingers with sherbet lemon, white chocolate lasagna, and cola bottle trifle. It all tasted a lot better than it sounds. I watch, transfixed, as 17-year-old Lily picks up the camera from its tripod and films some close-ups of Poppins the puppy. Then there is a shot of Nana hugging me and whispering in my ear. I can still remember what she said. I love you from here to the moon and back, 3 times and once for luck. It was something she only ever said to me, and the memory of that moment haunts me. The picture on the screen turns black. I've never seen anything that happened that evening captured on camera before. I didn't know this tape existed until now, so I wonder if that's all there is. But then an image of a beach at night appears, and a bonfire, and I don't want to see any more. I don't want to remember what happened next, or what I did. That night is why they all stopped speaking to me. It was the worst night of my life. Chapter 36. 31st of October, 3:55 a.m. Less than 3 hours until low tide. Maybe we shouldn't watch any more of this tape, says Rose in a voice that doesn't sound like her own. She remembers what happened that night too. So does Connor. I agree. Several members of this family have died tonight. This isn't the time for home movies, he says. But that isn't why Connor doesn't want to watch anymore. I ignore them both and cross the room to take a closer look at the Scrabble board Nana's agent gave to her that year. When I see what is on it, the room seems to spin. Did you do this? I ask Trixie, as she comes to stand by my side. We tend to be the only ones to play the game these days. Rose joins us to see what we are looking at and frowns at the board. Was this you? She asks our niece. It's really important that you tell the truth. Trixie shakes her head and stares wide-eyed at both of us. Someone has spelled out our names. Nana, Nancy, Frank, Connor, Lily, Rose, Daisy. Rose starts pacing again. I don't understand the connection to Nana's agent, or the link with Scrabble letters. Someone has been sticking them to the covers of our old home movies. But why would he be involved in any of this? Nana loved her agent. Because she couldn't write any more new books after what happened in 1988? Connor says, staring at the floor. She didn't publish anything ever again after that. What if he trashed her studio last night, looking for her latest work? If an author can't write, that's got to be bad for their agent too, right? I mean, she was his biggest client.
His first and only client for a while, I say, remembering how much I liked the man.
Rose shakes her head. We must be missing something. She turns to Lily, as though hoping she might have the answer. But Lily continues to face away from us all, staring at the TV screen, as if hypnotized by what she sees. For now, all it shows is an image of a bonfire on a beach at night. The fire in the room crackles and spits again, and I see what looks like a chair leg burning on top of the logs. It's painted blue with white clouds. I turn to Connor, and there is a scribble of a smile drawn on his face for no more than a second, before a frown erases it as though it were never there. But that doesn't mean anything. Sometimes our faces don't know what to do with themselves when we are scared. When I look back at the TV, I know that a lot of what happened after Nana's birthday meal and before the bonfire on the beach is missing.
moments that definitely weren't captured on camera, because Lily wasn't filming at the time. Unfortunately, my mind remembers that night well enough to fill in the gaps. Chapter 37. Seaglass, 1988.
Why did they get to go to a Halloween party and I have to stay here? I always have to stay behind. You never let me do anything,
I said to my mother, hoping that the vast amount of alcohol she had consumed that night might have made her change her mind. Saving an alcoholic seemed to turn her into one, albeit the functioning variety who people aren't as quick to condemn.
Because you're only 13, Nancy said, pouring another glass of wine.
So? You let Rose and Lily go to parties when they were my age?
You know as well as I do that your sisters aren't as...
What? Unhappy? Lonely? Bored?
Nancy tutted, and it made me so angry. It was the bad habit she was always so good at. The sound of people tutting still makes me cross. Sometimes my mother would tut for the benefit of nobody but herself when she thought she was alone and no one could hear her. Tut, tut, tut. It was her response to everything that irritated her, including me. Nancy steered me out of the room as though I were an embarrassment that Nana's agent shouldn't have to see.
Your sisters aren't as delicate as you are, she said, with a level of satisfaction that made me want to tut.
I'm not...
Daisy, I have spent my life protecting you from the world and looking after you.
That sounded like a joke to me. By then, my mother was a woman who could barely look after herself. After the breakup with Connor's father, she seemed smaller and had become a bit introverted. London was too loud for her, and our tiny townhouse was too claustrophobic with no real outdoor space. So we spent more time at Seaglass than ever before. Nancy sat alone in the garden for hours with her precious flowers, because they were all she had left of Connor's dad, and her only friends came in bottles. My mother had less time than ever for me, and she resented the pity and guilt I seemed to cause her to feel.
I am never going to let anything happen to you, she said, holding my shoulders a little too tight.
Sometimes it felt like she wanted me to stay sick and vulnerable forever. A lifetime of my mother protecting me meant that I didn't have much of a life or any friends of my own, not real ones. I didn't go to school, or brownies, or swimming lessons like my sisters. I didn't get to hang out with any other children my own age. Even now I find it hard to make friends, and sometimes I think it's because I never got taught how to do it. That was something neither Nancy nor Nana knew how to teach, because they didn't have any either. My childhood friends were Agatha Christie and Stephen King. When I look back, I think being homeschooled deprived me of so much more than anyone realized. I can understand why my mother didn't see the point in me learning algebra. That was something we did agree on. But there were plenty of things I couldn't teach myself by reading books. I didn't just miss out on the lessons most children learn in a classroom. There were life lessons I never knew about. I gave up demanding to be allowed out that night. There was no point arguing with my mother. You can't win an argument with someone who refuses to have one. I left them all to it and went up to my room, furious about being treated like a child when I no longer felt like one. Nancy wouldn't even let me read the letters from the hospital, even though they were about me. I thought about the last doctor I had seen, and how happy and cheerful he was compared to all the others. "Now go and live your life," he had said with a big smile on his face, as though there were nothing wrong with me at all. Living was all I wanted to do, so I couldn't understand why Nancy still insisted on locking me away and treating me like a porcelain doll. An hour or so after Nana's birthday dinner, the tide was almost low enough for Rose, Lily, and Connor to leave. They had changed into fancy dress for the annual Halloween beach party And, like always, I was going to miss out on all the fun. Whenever the three of them attended local parties, there was normally some coordination when it came to their costumes. That year, they were going as the lion, the witch, and the pumpkin. Rose was the lion, Lily was a witch, a role she was well rehearsed in, and Connor was dressed in what looked like an orange sack. I sat at the top of the stairs, watching them put on their coats and say their goodbyes. Then I heard the front door slam and listened to the adults return to the kitchen and their drinks. In my fury at the injustice of it all, I stumbled into the old wicker hamper on the landing, the one that we used for dressing up games when we were younger. I kicked it in frustration, then had an idea. I opened up the hamper, pulling out homemade Ghostbuster and Gizmo costumes, along with witches' hats and wigs, but realised none of it would be enough to change my appearance and hide my face. Then I found the old sheet from my performance as a ghost a few years earlier. I pulled it over my head, lined up the two holes with my eyes, and looked in the mirror. Then I put the sheet in my backpack and hatched a plan. After using cuddly toys to make a me-shaped lump in my bed, I crept downstairs and let myself out of the front door. I ran across the causeway as fast as I could with the moon lighting my way, constantly checking over my shoulder to see if I'd been caught escaping. Then I scrambled up the cliff path until my sisters and Connor were only a few metres ahead of me. They were taking the long route, which was safest when it was dark, but I knew a shortcut and reached Connor's car before they did, just in time to climb inside the boot. Nobody ever used to bother locking their cars when leaving them behind the sand dunes back then. Things have changed so much since 1988. These days, we are taught to suspect others of doing us harm at all times. Connor had borrowed the old blue Volvo from his dad, without Mr. Kennedy's knowledge or consent. Forgiveness is easier to ask for than permission, but Connor no longer asked his father for either. The car was already as battered and broken as its owner. Since his return to drowning his sorrows, Connor's dad had driven home drunk from the pub on more than one occasion, often driving into a wall or a tree along the way, but at a speed that luckily only dented his pride and the vehicle. Connor had only recently passed his test, a few days earlier, and was keen to impress Rose before she went off to university. He opened the passenger door for his girlfriend, leaving Lily to help herself to the back seat. She sprayed on her poison perfume, stinking the entire car out. She was already wearing more than enough to scare a skunk, and the smell made me want to sneeze. I covered my nose and mouth with my hands and stayed as quiet as I could in my hiding place. "Nice wheels," Lily said unkindly, and Connor slammed his door so hard I'm surprised it didn't fall off its hinges. As he started the engine, I wondered whether there was enough air in the boot for me to survive the journey. The car coughed and spluttered a few times before coming to life, and I began to panic. My heart was thudding in my chest, and I could feel a sneeze trying to escape my nose, which it did, but luckily Connor turned on the car stereo at the exact same time. He pushed a cassette tape inside, and a song called "Don't Worry, Be Happy" started to play, replacing the noise of the radio. My sisters knew all the words, and they sang along as Connor pulled out from behind the sand dunes and started driving down the winding cliff road. It was a bumpy ride, and I felt car sick, but it was only a 5-minute drive to the other end of Black Sand Bay where the Halloween gathering was being held. I was 13, but the only parties I'd ever been to before were hosted at Sea Glass by Nana. The excitement I felt outweighed the fear. It was exhilarating. When we finally stopped driving, I waited for them all to get out, then I tried to open the boot. It wouldn't budge. Connor had locked the car. I imagined them walking away and me running out of oxygen, and my sense of panic went from 0 to 100 before I could take another breath. I screamed. Connor's face when he opened the boot was not one of his happy ones. He was busy inflating his Halloween costume, and I had clearly interrupted him halfway.
"Have you lost your tiny mind?" Lily asked, blowing a bubble of gum in my face. "What were you thinking, Daisy?" Rose said, sounding just like our mother. "If anything had happened to you..."
"Come on, credit where credit is due. She wanted to come to the party and she came," said Connor with a kind smile.
He reattached a nozzle to his costume and started stepping on a foot pump.
"She'll ruin this year's theme," Lily moaned. "The lion, the witch, the pumpkin and the daisy doesn't have quite the same ring to it."
Connor ignored her. With every enthusiastic foot pump, I could see that he was wearing an inflatable pumpkin costume.
"This is an adult party," whined Lily.
"Then you should probably go home," I said.
"Watch it, pipsqueak," Lily snapped.
My dad's nickname for me morphed from a term of endearment into an insult whenever she used it.
"Lily's right," said Rose. "Some of the others might feel a bit funny about a 13-year-old being on the beach and seeing what they get up to."
"I brought this,"
I said, pulling the white sheet ghost costume out of my bag. I was allowed to stay, because none of them wanted to leave, but only if I promised to remain hidden under my makeshift costume for the entire evening. I didn't mind. I was just excited to be out with other people, witnessing a snapshot of humanity firsthand instead of reading about it in a book or seeing it on TV. It was a big step for someone who rarely went anywhere without her mother. Peering through those two holes in the sheet felt like looking at life through a tunnel. A bit like the Viewmaster my dad gave me one Christmas. I liked the imagined safety of my disguise. It meant that I could see everything without being seen. And I wanted to make the most of it, because I knew that the things, people and parties that had always been out of reach before were within touching distance for one night only. Everything that happened next was a real education. After so many years of feeling like I'd been missing out, I actually missed being at home. It was cold on the beach at night, and curling up in an armchair in front of the fire with a good novel and a mug of hot chocolate suddenly seemed a lot more appealing. The party consisted of 15 or so boys and girls, some of whom I'd seen before, but were still strangers to me, all sitting around a small fire on the beach, drinking cheap cider and white wine. Connor, our designated driver, drank Coke, to begin with. I knew better than to drink alcohol with the cocktail of drugs my mother made me take every day to keep my heart ticking, but I did have an occasional sip of Rose's wine when nobody was looking. I didn't like the way it tasted. It was nothing like Nana's birthday champagne, which I tried earlier that evening. But I wanted to know what it was like to be like the others. How it felt to be normal. After an hour of sitting on the beach with a sheet over my head, all I felt was cold and tired and a little bit sick. I concluded that being normal might be overrated. Lily drank more than the rest of us combined, and it was her suggestion to play spin the bottle.
"You have to kiss whoever it points to when it stops spinning. I'll go first," Lily said, with a naughty grin stretched across her pretty face.
The other kids smiled too. Everyone except Rose seemed to be having a good time. We all watched as the bottle spun, a zoetrope of drunken teenage faces lit up by the flickering light of the fire. It seemed to spin forever, but then it stopped, and the bottleneck pointed at the boy next to Connor. Without hesitation, Lily took out her bubblegum, then leaned over and kissed him. There were tongues involved, and it looked unpleasant. She popped her gum back in her mouth afterwards and smiled at everyone. Sex was a mystery to me back then. I'd read about it and thought about it, but the idea of actually doing it seemed both unnecessary and unhygienic. Watching Lily kiss a random boy only made me feel more queasy.
"Connor's turn next," Lily declared.
I don't really want to play. Man up! Perhaps you can write about it for the local newspaper, she said when he tried to refuse. Connor, a now slightly deflated orange pumpkin, leaned forward and reluctantly played the game. He stared at Rose the whole time the bottle spun, but it stopped on Lily. I've never seen her look more delighted. Sometimes when we think we know what we want but don't get it, we look for something or someone else to fill the gap. Lily had always been jealous of Connor and Rose being together. Not because she really wanted to be with Connor, but because she always wanted whatever Rose had. Lily couldn't stand being left out of anything. She marched around the fire and kissed him before he had a chance to protest or run away, and I noticed Rose drink from her bottle of wine until it looked half empty. Delicious, Lily said with a drunken smile as soon as their lips parted. That was the year she started smoking, so I imagine it wasn't delicious for him at all. Who wants to go skinny dipping? She asked everyone, and nobody in particular. Then she stood up and removed her witch's hat, black dress and shoes, before running towards the sea in just her underwear. It looked whiter than white in the moonlight. Despite the cold, a few of the boys from around the fire followed her. Lily had made more than a bit of a name for herself by then. Her variety of fun was mostly harmless, and only ever born out of a desperate need for affection. But rumours ruin far more reputations than reality. Despite the unpleasant things that people sometimes said, in that moment, I would have given anything to have been my sister. Everyone seemed to adore her. She was fun and beautiful, full of life and free. While I was only ever me. Chapter 38 Sea Glass, 1988. Rose stormed off in the other direction, disappearing down the beach, her lion's tail swinging as she walked. And Connor the pumpkin chased after her. If I didn't feel so ill, I might have found the whole scene funny. You're the youngest, darker sister under there, aren't you? Asked a boy I recognised from Rose's 16th birthday party at Sea Glass. He sat down next to me, so close that I could smell the beer on his breath. The wine had made me very sleepy, and I didn't try to stop him at first, as he attempted to remove the sheet from my head and peek underneath. I was tired of pretending to be a ghost and of being treated like one all my life, but part of me wanted to stay hidden. I pulled the sheet back down. I wish it was Daisy Darker under there, he said, backing off a little. I was hoping that the bottle might land on her if I spun it, he whispered, even though there was nobody else left by the fire to hear. I didn't know what to say to that, so said nothing. Or maybe we could play a little game of trick or treat if you don't like spin the bottle, he suggested innocently, as though we were discussing what board game to play on a rainy Sunday afternoon. I don't know how to play trick or treat, I replied. It's easy. I'll teach you. But come a little closer first, you're shivering. I'll keep you warm. I looked around for my sisters, but they were nowhere to be seen. Everyone else had wandered away from the fire except the boy and me. I shuffled an inch closer, and he smiled. First, the trick, he said. If you can guess which hand I'm holding this chocolate coin in, you can eat the treat. But if you guess wrong, you have to take the sheet off your head. I looked at the chocolate in its shiny gold foil wrapping and nodded. The game seemed simple and harmless enough. He put his hands behind his back, then held two closed fists out in front of me to choose from. The hand I chose was empty, so I took off the sheet, and he smiled. That's better, and look how beautiful you are.
No wonder your sisters always want to leave you at home. You outshine them both. Play again?
I think that was the first time a stranger had ever paid me a proper compliment. I knew I wasn't really beautiful, not compared to Rose or Lily, but I confess that I liked someone saying that I was, even if it wasn't true. I nodded a silent agreement to play again, and he held out two closed fists. I chose wrong a second time.
I'm afraid that means one of these comes undone, he said,
unhooking one of the clips on my dungaree dress. When I lost again, he unhooked the other. Then he tried to kiss me and I tried to let him. I had never been kissed before. It was cold and wet, and I kept my mouth firmly closed as he tried to stick his tongue inside it. I closed my eyes, too, as though I didn't want to see what was happening. I'd always dreamt of Connor being the first boy who I kissed, perhaps because he was the only boy I really knew. I'm sure I wasn't the only girl in the world to fantasize about their sister's boyfriend, and it was him I imagined as I let this 18-year-old stranger kiss 13-year-old me. I don't expect people to understand, but according to all the doctors I spent my childhood visiting, I only had a couple of years left. I didn't know then what the most recent doctor had said to Nancy about a dramatic change in my life expectancy. And I didn't want to die never having been kissed. When you know you can't make long-term plans, it's easy to let yourself make short-term mistakes. Try to relax, the boy whispered, kissing my neck, and I noticed the shiny foil chocolate on the black sand behind us. It was never in either of his hands. Those lying fingers were busy instead sliding up and under my top before pulling it off over my head. I was wearing a hand-me-down training bra and felt nothing but shame. The cold air stole my breath from me, tiny clouds of it escaping from my mouth. It reminded me of the cloud creatures I used to try to see in the sky when I was a little girl, and I imagined seeing a lion, a witch, and a pumpkin as the boy reached behind my back, trying and failing to unfasten my bra. I saw someone dressed as a devil run past laughing, and I felt afraid, even though I knew it was just a costume. Nana taught us that the devil is not a fictional man with a red cape and horns. He's the voice inside our heads that tells us to do things we shouldn't. He's the eyes that pretend not to see, and the ears that pretend not to hear. He's you. He's me. He's all of us. The full moon was a flirt that night, teasing the sky with little glimpses of itself, only occasionally coming out from behind the clouds. They all started to look like devils too. The boy kissed me again, still trying to take off my bra. "Wait, stop," I said, feeling very sick all of a sudden. "Oh, you're so beautiful, I just want to see it," the boy said, staring at my chest. "See what?" I asked. "Your scar. You won't die if we do this, will you? Can I touch it?" I knew there and then that if that was what it was like to be normal, I'd rather be me. I pushed him away, covered myself up, and fled. "Freak!" he called after me, then laughed. I cried because he was right. I was a freak. A freak with a broken heart who would never love or be loved. A freak who had been kissed for the first time by a horrible, disgusting boy. A freak who wanted to disappear. But first, I wanted to go home. I couldn't see Rose or Connor anywhere on the beach, but I thought I could hear Lily laughing with one of the boys behind the rocks. She has always craved attention, especially from men. Little girls who lose their fathers spend their lives looking for them in every man they meet. In my tired, slightly drunken state, I thought Lily would look after me. The rocks were covered in barnacles and seaweed, but I kept climbing until I was high enough to see without being seen. I was right. Lily was talking to a boy. The boy was Connor.
"Rose is upset with me," he said, then took a swig from what looked like a bottle of whiskey, just like the ones his dad liked to drink.
"She'll get over it, pumpkin," Lily replied, grabbing the bottle from him and taking a swig herself. She screwed up her face as though she hated the taste, but then drank some more.
"Besides, Rose is going to university. You've got a job on the local newspaper. It was never going to be forever. You'll be breaking up soon anyway when she meets some brainiac at Cambridge. May as well rip off the band-aid now, if you ask me."
"How can you say that? I love Rose," Connor said, sounding like he might cry. "And she loves me." Denial is often a down payment for future heartbreak.
"Then why, deep down, do you already know she's going to dump you?" said Lily. She was still in her underwear, but had a towel wrapped around her.
"I know the truth hurts, and I'm sorry to be the one saying it, but we both know Rose is out of your league. I understand how you're feeling. Rose is leaving me too," Lily said, taking a step towards Connor.
"Maybe we could help each other feel better?"
"How?" he asked, taking another sip of whiskey.
I stared at Lily's feet as she took another step towards him. Her toenails were painted red, and I knew the varnish must have belonged to our mother.
I had stolen all of Lily's nail varnishes a week earlier, when she refused to let me borrow any of them. There were 10 in total, and I used them to paint each of my toenails a different colour, before burying each tiny glass bottle in the sand outside Sea Glass. I imagined the crabs that lived in Black Sand Bay finding them and taking it in turns to paint one another's claws.
Lily's towel dropped onto the ground, and she took one more step towards Connor until their lips were almost touching. Her white underwear seemed to glow in the moonlight against a backdrop of black sand.
"Rose might be the clever one in the family, but there are all kinds of things I know how to do that she doesn't," Lily said, not taking her eyes off his.
"I could show you if you like, or we could just kiss it better," she added, pressing herself up against him.
"Just tonight, then never again? It could be our little secret."
But they didn't just kiss. I watched from my hiding place above the rocks while they did what they did beneath them. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. Connor accidentally called Lily Rose at one point, but she didn't seem to mind.
1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi.
I think it was the toxic mix of shock and revulsion and heartbreak that prevented me from moving or saying a word. There are times when we all stand still while the ghosts of our pasts run by, and that's how I felt. Like a ghost. I watched, unable to look away, just like people rubbernecking at a car crash, until it was over.
1 Mississippi.
Then I slipped on the rocks, and they both looked up and saw me.
Chapter 39. 31st of October, 4 a.m. 2 hours until low tide. The clocks out in the hall start to chime 4 o'clock, and nobody says a word.
My memories of that night did not appear on the TV screen. All we saw just now was some teenagers sitting around a bonfire on a beach in 1988. But it's a night both of my sisters and Connor and I would rather forget. We've never really spoken about what happened after I caught Connor and Lily together. And none of them have ever forgiven me for what happened next, even though it was not my fault.
I don't want to see any more of this, Connor says.
He crosses the room and ejects the tape.
It's only 2 hours until we can leave, less if we don't mind getting our feet wet. I vote we just sit in silence while we wait. No more home movies, no more unhappy trips down the darker family memory lane.
He crosses the room and throws the VHS tape on the fire. When it doesn't catch light straight away, he adds another log to the flames. But it isn't a log in his hand. It's another sky blue chair leg painted with white clouds. Someone has chopped up the chair Nana once painted for Connor and left it here to burn. He turns to stare at us.
I don't know which one of you is responsible for all of this, but I'm not playing along anymore. It's sick. That's the only word for what is happening here tonight. This ends now.
I don't remember anyone putting you in charge, says Rose.
Someone needs to be, for Trixie's sake. The poor kid doesn't stand a chance growing up in this family. It isn't as though Lily will ever win Mother of the Year.
I'm shocked by Connor's outburst. I think we all are. But most of all, I'm shocked that Lily doesn't respond. It's not in her nature to stay quiet. She's still just staring at the TV screen, even though there is nothing on it. Rose finds it strange, too. Lily? She says. Trixie, who has been sitting next to me since I called her to the Scrabble board, walks over to Lily and taps her gently on the shoulder. Mum? Lily's head bows as though she has fallen asleep. Her face twists towards us at an unnatural angle, and she looks a little faded, like a watercolour painting of herself by someone who got bored halfway through.
Lily!
Rose shouts as our sister falls sideways onto the sofa. She pushes Trixie out of the way and leans over Lily, checking for any signs of life.
Oh my God, she's not breathing! Mum!
Trixie screams, trying to get closer. It gets very loud in the room very quickly.
Don't you dare die!
Shouts Rose, starting CPR. The words seem to detonate inside Trixie's ears, and she covers them with her hands as Connor pulls her out of the way.
There are strange marks on Lily's neck, I say, trying to help in any way that I can. Are those bruises?
Connor asks, noticing them too. Rose shakes her head.
No, they look more like burns to me. Come on, Lily. If you can hear me, I need you to breathe.
The rest of us watch in silent horror as she continues with chest compressions and mouth to mouth. Trixie is crying, so am I, and I can't process any of what I am seeing or hearing as I try to comfort my niece. Eventually, Rose stops and shakes her head.
It's too late,
she whispers, tears streaming down her face.
She's gone.
Are you sure?
Connor asks Rose.
Of course, I'm bloody sure.
We all stare at Lily in silence, while the fire crackles and spits, and the VHS tape of that terrible night burns. Rose takes a woolen throw from the sofa and uses it to cover Lily's body. Although I'm sure we've all seen them, nobody mentions the two objects that have been tied to her hands, which are still visible. We were in the same room as her and we didn't even notice. In one of Lily's hands there is a bottle of perfume. In the other, there is a hand mirror, both held in place with red ribbons. Lily.
Daisy Darker's sister Lily was the vainest of the lot. She was a selfish, spoilt, entitled witch, one who deserved to get shot. Lily was a jealous woman, too quick to complain and moan. She wanted too much, but gave too little, and chose to make hate her home. When she slept with her daughter's father, it was never a question of love. It was to settle a score that boys liked her more, even though they all gave her the shove. Nobody was more shocked than herself when Lily became a mother. She wasn't clever or kind, and was really quite blind when it came to the feelings of others. But the child was her best achievement, and somehow grew up to be good. It proved that apples do sometimes fall far from the tree and grow in a different wood. When the time came, no one knew who to blame when she was poisoned by her own perfume. With her skin so cold and the rash on her neck rather old, she was a long time dead in that room.
Chapter 40. 31st of October, 4:10 a.m. Less than 2 hours until low tide.
"I think there might have been some kind of poison in her perfume," says Rose.
"What?" asks Connor. "Why would you think something like that, let alone say it?
People have been killing each other with perfume for centuries. Everyone in this family knows that Lily is constantly spraying herself. Look at those marks on her neck and wrists. And the perfume bottle has been tied to her hand. You don't have to be Poirot to work it out."
"What could possibly have been in a perfume bottle that would have killed her?" Connor says, almost as though he is accusing Rose.
"I don't know. I'm a vet, not a chemist. My sister has just died. Someone is killing my whole family. Stop asking me stupid questions," she says.
Connor frowns, backs off a little.
"I'm sorry."
Rose doesn't reply. I've always thought that the best way to truly know a person is to listen to them. Not just to what they say, but to what they don't. All sorts of secrets are neatly tucked inside the silent gaps between words. The simple act of listening is a forgotten art in our loud world. I don't think Connor has ever really forgiven Rose for breaking up with him after what happened that night. And I don't think she has ever forgiven him for what he did. I don't mean him sleeping with Lily.
"I said, I'm sorry," Connor repeats.
And Rose turns on him.
"Are you? Which part are you specifically sorry for? And why are you even here? Nobody in this family has spoken to you for years except for Nana. She might have still cared about you, but the rest of us don't. You were dead to me, to all of us. Whenever people are stupid enough to care about you, bad things happen. You should have stayed away."
Rose leans over Lily's body and holds her close before crying again.
"You should have stayed away," she repeats, as her tears continue to freefall.
They both seem oblivious to the child in the room who has just lost her mother. Trixie is trembling and sobbing so hard she can barely breathe. I try my best to comfort her.
"I think whoever has been killing off the family is in this room," says Connor, looking at Rose. "It's the only option that makes sense now."
"Is that so?" she replies. "And who do you think did it? Me?"
"Well, who else could it be? Do you think it was a 15-year-old child? Or perhaps sweet little Daisy has decided to finally get revenge for what happened that night?"
Connor says, looking wilder than I've ever seen. I ignore them both, because looking after Trixie is more important than their childish accusations at the moment. "It's going to be all right," I tell my niece, who is still covering her ears with her hands. I don't know what will happen to Trixie now, who she will live with or who will take care of her, but I'm determined to do everything I can to play my part in keeping her safe. None of us know who Trixie's father is. Lily never told us. And I sometimes wonder whether that was because she didn't know. You're going to be okay. Sit down here with me, I say, and Trixie does. I won't let anything bad happen to you, I promise. She nods, but doesn't look up. I don't think she believes me. Given everything that has happened tonight, I worry whether it is a promise I will be able to keep. I can't help wondering what witnessing all of this horror might do to a child long term. As Rose and Connor continue to accuse each other, Trixie hugs her knees to her chest and closes her eyes, but I can still see the steady stream of tears falling from them. I look at the Scrabble board on the table behind us, with all of our names intertwined, just like all families are in real life. Even if they wish they weren't.
I agree with you, Rose says to Connor. I also think it is only logical now that the person responsible must be in this room. My money is on you.
Me?
Connor replies.
How on earth did you reach that conclusion?
All the terrible things that have happened took place after you appeared, unexpected and alone in the middle of the night, allegedly by boat, not that any of us saw one. You could have been here the whole time, waiting for us to arrive and waiting for the tide to come in so we couldn't leave. If anyone should be under suspicion right now, I'd say it was you. He doesn't get a chance to reply, because a floorboard squeaks above us. Everything stops, and we stare wide-eyed at one another as the sound of someone walking in the room above our heads continues. Trixie stops crying and peers at the ceiling in silence. I can't even hear the clocks ticking out in the hallway. Time seems to pause for a little while, politely waiting for us all to catch up. Rose, Connor, Trixie and I look at one another, confusion and fear on our faces, as we try to understand who is upstairs. Chapter 41 31st of October, 4:15 a.m. Less than 2 hours until low tide.
We've got to get out of this house and off the island, Rose whispers.
How? Are you going to swim to shore?
Connor whispers back.
If I have to. There is someone else here at Seaglass. We just heard them walking around upstairs. I don't plan to hang around and wait for someone else to die.
It's all quiet up above again now, almost as though we imagined it.
Maybe it was Poppins upstairs. She's already given us a fright tonight, I suggest.
Poppins, having heard her name, appears from behind the sofa, where she sometimes likes to sleep. She stares in my direction and wags her tail. The dog never stopped loving me, despite what happened. Animals don't know how to hate or hold a grudge.
At least we have the gun to defend ourselves, Connor says.
That's true, I say.
But Rose turns a paler shade of white.
What? Connor asks.
Rose shakes her head.
I left the gun in the library when I changed into some dry clothes. It was in my jacket pocket. I don't have it.
Well, that's just great, Connor mutters.
I put it on the chair, then I took off my wet things. I must have put them on top of it, and then I just forgot. You knocked on the door when I was still getting changed and distracted me.
Of course, it's my fault, says Connor.
We should get out of here anyway. We're sitting ducks if we stay in this room. Nana's library is smaller, safer. We can lock ourselves in there and I can get the gun. We need to move, all of us, now, says Rose.
She takes the master key from her pocket and opens the little door that joins the lounge and the library. All the downstairs rooms have these doors connecting them. It reminds me of the times when Lily used to open them up and roller skate through the house, lap after dizzying lap. but I don't remember seeing any of the internal doors open since we were children. It amazes me how Rose can still think so quickly and clearly and stay so calm.
Maybe whoever is out there doesn't know about these doors, she whispers. Or maybe they do, says Connor. It must be someone who knows the place pretty well. How else would they be able to sneak around Seaglass all night without being seen?
We stop for a moment, as if thoughts can only surface when we are still.
The sound of the storm would have drowned out the noise of someone creeping around the house. But who would be familiar enough with this place to know it so well? Nana was super private. She rarely had visitors, I whisper.
Rose nods.
The only people I can remember Nana ever inviting here, for years now, were the people she thought of as family.
What about her agent? Connor says.
Yes. She trusted him. And there's the Scrabble connection,
Rose replies, almost to herself.
What makes you think a man is behind all of this?
Your dad. Frank was a big guy. Moving his body from the music room to the cupboard wouldn't have been easy. I think even I would have struggled to lift him. Remember how hard it was for us to move Nancy? And she weighed nothing at all.
You have a very morbid sense of logic, says Rose. I understand your theory about Nana's agent, but we all know she hasn't written a new book for years. I don't know if they're even still in touch.
He was here yesterday. I saw his card in the cubbyhole by the punch clock. Either he forgot to punch out,
or he didn't leave,
I whisper, wishing I'd thought to mention it earlier. I only met him that one time, but he seemed like such a lovely man. The footsteps above our heads resume, and we all look up in terror.
Hurry, come on, into the library, Rose says. You too, Poppins, she adds,
and the old dog gets up and trots behind her. As soon as we are inside, Rose starts locking all of the doors, trapping us in the small room. Connor starts pacing, and Trixie stands on her own by the window in the corner. She looks so small in her pink pajamas. Trixie might be 15, but she's still a child who has just lost her mother. I rush to her side, but she barely notices, and I doubt she'll ever get over this. I suspect none of us will. Rose starts throwing her things into her bag, almost hitting Poppins with a wet jumper in the process. Then she freezes.
What's wrong? I ask.
She turns back to stare at us all.
My gun was right here on the chair earlier.
And?
Connor asks.
And now, it's gone.